Welcome to Circulation on the Run, your weekly podcast summary and backstage pass to the journal and its editors. I'm Dr. Carolyn Lam, associate editor from the National Heart Center and Duke National University of Singapore.
And I'm Greg Hunley, director of the Pauley Heart Center at VCU Health in Richmond, Virginia. Well, Carolyn, our feature this week has to do with aortic size, aneurysms, and predilection to dissection. But before we get to that, how about if we grab a cup of coffee and go through some of the other articles in the issue?
I got my coffee, Greg. And you know what? I'm going to start with a quiz for you. All right. True or false? In the setting of obesity and or diabetes, cardiac substrate metabolism shifts towards increased fatty acid oxidation while lipid accumulates in the heart. True or false? Of course, you're right. Oh, but there's a part two. Can you guess, by increasing fatty acid oxidation, will we induce or prevent obesity-induced lipotoxic cardiomyopathy?
I'm going to say, because you asked it and the way you asked it, prevent.
Wow. All right. Well, the truth is we didn't really know before today's paper. The specific link between cardiac metabolism and lipotoxic cardiomyopathy was elusive, and there was no specific therapy available for this condition. And these authors, Dr. Rong Tian from University of Washington and colleagues, hypothesized that cardiac pathology-associated obesity would be attributable to the imbalance of fatty acid supply and oxidation. So using a diet-induced obesity model in the current study, they demonstrated that enhancing fatty acid oxidation through deletion of acetyl-CoA carboxylase 2 was sufficient to prevent obesity-induced cardiomyopathy. So increasing cardiac fatty acid oxidation alone does not cause cardiac dysfunction, but instead protects against cardiomyopathy in chronically obese mice. The cardiac protective effect of increasing fatty acid oxidation in obese mice is through maintenance of Parkin-mediated mitophagy and thus preventing mitochondrial dysfunction. These findings indicate that impaired mitophagy contributes to mitochondrial dysfunction in obese mice, and that targeting the Parkin-pendant pathway is a viable therapeutic intervention for obesity-induced cardiomyopathy.
Very nice, Carolyn.
I'm going to be greedy and go on to my next paper. So, Greg, do you think cardiac regeneration is possible?
Well, Carolyn, I would have said several years ago, no, but that trip that we took to China with Joe Hill and Hesham Sadek, our associate editor and our chief editor, convinced me otherwise. So I'm going to definitely answer yes on this one.
Oh, Greg, you're just too smart. And speaking of China, this next paper is from there, from co-corresponding authors Dr. Nie and Hu from Fuwai Hospital National Center for Cardiovascular Disease and Chinese Academy of Medical Sciences and Peking Union Medical College. So using seven genetic mouse lines, they identified that Oncostatin M is the top upregulated cytokine during neonatal heart regeneration. Oncostatin M is a pleiotropic secretory protein that belongs to the interleukin-6 family and associates with the pathological process of dilated cardiomyopathy. And these authors found that macrophages promote heart regeneration by secreting oncostatin M, which promotes cardiomyocyte proliferation via a co-receptor GP130. Employing RNA-seq and functional screening, they further found that CERC-mediated GP130 triggered cardiomyocyte proliferation by activating the downstream signaling pathway involving YAP with Y357 phosphorylation independent of the Hippo pathway. So the last thing that they did was show that gene therapy with adenovirus-associated virus encoding this activated GP130 improved heart regeneration and pumping function, thus serving as a potential therapeutic target. An amazing paper.
Very nice, Carolyn. What a great summary and so much detail. Well, Carolyn, I'm going to turn our attention to catecholaminergic polymorphic ventricular tachycardia. And this article comes to us from Dr. Jason Roberts from the Western University. Carolyn, genetic variants in calsequestrin 2 can cause an autosomal recessive form of catecholaminergic polymorphic ventricular tachycardia, though isolated reports have identified arrhythmogenic phenotypes among heterozygotes. So in this study, a total of 112 individuals, including 36 catecholaminergic polymorphic ventricular tachycardia probands, 24 were homozygotes or compound heterozygotes, and 12 were pure heterozygotes, against 76 family members possessing at least one presumed pathogenic calsequestrin 2 variant. These were all identified.
Wow, a very precious cohort. So what did they find, Greg?
This international multicenter study of calsequestrin 2, catecholaminergic polymorphic ventricular tachycardia, really redefined its heritability and confirmed that pathogenic heterozygous calsequestrin 2 variants may manifest with a catecholaminergic polymorphic ventricular tachycardia phenotype, indicating a need to clinically screen these individuals. Among individuals heterozygous for a pathogenic calsequestrin 2 rare variant, medical therapy and exercise restriction are likely not necessary in the absence of the catecholaminergic polymorphic ventricular tachycardia phenotype. Though you have to be certain over time, an intermittent clinical screening to ensure they remain phenotype negative should be obtained.
Wow, Greg, clinically important study there. Well, I'm going to go back to the basic science world and talk about calcineurin. Now, calcineurin has long been implicated in the induction of pathological cardiac remodeling, but has not been therapeutically targetable for the prevention of heart failure because of its pleiotropy and our lack of understanding of its specific protein-protein interactions and compartmentation within the cardiomyocyte.
Okay, Carolyn, do you want me to give background on calcineurin?
No, Greg, you're off the hook. I'm going to give you some background on calcineurin. So calcineurin is the calcium calmodulin-dependent phosphatase that exists as a heterodimer, consisting of a catalytic subunit and a regulatory subunit. Now, of the three catalytic subunit isoforms, alpha, beta, gamma, it's the beta isoform that appears to be the most important for the development of cardiac hypertrophy. Binding of calcium to the calcineurin regulatory subunit enables binding of the calcium calmodulin complex, thereby releasing autoinhibition and freeing the enzyme to dephosphorylate downstream substrates. So that's the background. Now, in today's issue, we have this great paper from co-corresponding authors, Dr. Kapilov from Stanford University and Dr. Nikolev from University Medical Center Hamburg. And with their colleagues, they described the discovery of a calcineurin catalytic subunit beta binding protein, CDC42 interacting protein 4, and I'm going to call that CIP4, which functions as a scaffold to sequester the pool of calcineurin near the sarcolemma of cardiomyocytes, where it regulates pro-hypertrophic signaling. These findings have really important implications for understanding how cardiac calcineurin is selectively activated by stress signals, as opposed to the pleiotropic second messenger, calcium, that really floods the cardiomyocytes during each contractile cycle. Furthermore, the data provide proof of concept for an innovative therapeutic approach whereby CIP4 anchoring activity is selectively inhibited to block the action of a small pathogenic pool of calcineurin as a means of treating heart failure. How about that? This is really discussed in an elegant editorial by Drs. Wolf, Travers, and McKinsey.
Very interesting, Carolyn. Sounds like another possibility for treating and managing heart failure. Well, let me share with you some of the other findings in our mailbag this week. First, I've got from Professor Lang Lee and Stephen Wiviot. They swap research correspondence regarding the prior publication entitled Effect of Dapagliflozin on Atrial Fibrillation in Patients with Type 2 Diabetes Mellitus, Insights from the DECLARE-TIMI-58 Trial. And then Professor Laszlo Littman has a nice ECG challenge for us related to a high-risk ECG that exposed some downstream worrisome vital signs.
In addition, there's a perspective piece by Dr. Nambi discussing the fact that a zero calcium score is desirable, but is it enough to defer therapy given that up to one-third of events will occur in this group? There's also an in-depth paper by Dr. Borlaug entitled Altered Hemodynamics and End-Organ Damage in Heart Failure, the Impact on the Lung and Kidney. And oh boy, this one is so beautifully illustrated, just a must read for the understanding of the hemodynamics in the lung and kidney and heart failure. Next, there's a research letter by Dr. Lewis on enrichment of rare variants in the Lewis-Dietz syndrome genes in spontaneous coronary artery dissection and not in severe fibromuscular dysplasia. And finally, another research letter by Dr. Arora on racial differences in serial NT-proBNP levels in heart failure management with insights from the GUIDE-IT trial. What a rich issue. But let's move on to our featured discussion, shall we?
You bet, Carolyn. Well, listeners, we're now getting to our feature discussion, and it's very interesting this week where we're going to evaluate aortic aneurysms. And we have with us one of the lead authors of this paper, Dr. Charlotte Anderson from Boston Medical Center, and our own associate editor, Naveed Sitar from Glasgow, Scotland. Charlotte, welcome to our feature discussion. Could you tell us a little bit about the background and the hypothesis that you put forward with this study?
So the background for this study was based on clinical work and what we observed in clinic. We had a few patients where we had been stroken by the fact that they came in with an acute aortic syndrome and they had a first degree relative themselves with the condition, but they did not look syndromic at all. And we started to wonder, what is the actual risk in the community in people without obvious syndromic features of suffering from an aortic event itself? And although there is quite a few studies out there that have to some degree focused on the familial clustering of orthopathies, there is not a lot of information based on communities and whole entire populations. So we wanted to frankly estimate what is the incidence rates of aortic dissections and aortic aneurysm in the community if you have a first degree relative that has suffered from the disease themselves.
How did you organize your study and what was your population and what was your design?
This study was actually based on two independent samples. First, we used the Framingham Heart Study population that is very densely phenotyped over many years, spanning three generations of participants, where we looked at people who had at least one parent who had an aortic size in the upper quartile, indexed to body surface area, and adjusted for age and sex. And we saw what's the risk of you as a child having an aortic size in the same upper quartile. And second, we looked in the general Danish population. The Danish healthcare system is, as you probably know, governmental funded, and we have very good registries of all hospitalizations, all outpatient visits. And so we were able to link more hard clinical events in people with and without a first degree relative. What we did was we started time when people had an aortic dissection. We identified all the first degree relatives in these people and we matched them with up to 10 sex and age match controls from the general population without a first degree relative with the disease.
What did you find?
We found that in the Framingham sample, if you had at least one parent who belonged to the upper quartile of aortic size, you had an odds ratio of 2 to 3 adjusted for various clinical risk factors, such as hypertension and smoking yourself. And in the Danish population, we found that if you had a first degree relative with an orthopathy, the hazard ratios for you developing the disease yourself was almost a tenfold increased compared to age and sex match controls. And importantly, it seemed like these hazard ratios were more or less unchanged when we sought adjusting for various known risk factors such as bicuspid aortic valve, Marfan syndrome, and Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, and those kind of things. And we also found that the younger your proband were at the time of an acute event, the higher was your relative risk yourself. So among people who were below the age of 50 when they suffered an event, the hazard ratios were up to a 50-fold increased.
Very nice. Naveed, what attracted you to this article as it was coming through the editorial process? And then second, how do we take the information that Charlotte's just conveyed and will be published here today? How do we take this in the context of what we already know about aortic aneurysms?
I think it's a beautiful study. So well done, Charlotte. I think it's a beautiful fusion, as Charlotte has said, an in-depth cohort study, which has got very well measured, you know, parameters at systematic points, and a fantastic, you know, sort of population-based data set from Denmark, which, you know, Sweden shares and Scotland shares, and relatively small countries like us share. So small countries like Denmark punch above their weight in these kind of studies, which is fantastic. But there's a rich seam of research that comes from these, and this is one of them. So I think that fusion of two data sets from, you know, with different strengths and limitations combined, giving up same signals, is good. I think, as Charlotte said, this is the first major population study to look at this question. So there's been people around the world have got this sense that aortic aneurysm may well be familial. This provides probably some of the best data to suggest, yes, it definitely is. Now, the question is going forward is, okay, at what point do you screen everybody who's got a family history, you know, with a proband? Or do you screen those who've got a family history of younger probands? And I think what Charlotte and the team and other people around the world are going to look at this say, okay, we now think, in addition to screening, for example, in the UK and the US, we probably screen just men above 65, where most of the disease is. Do we also then implement screening in younger people with family histories? And who do we screen and when and how? And do we need to develop some kind of risk score? And then when we do that screening, what do we do about it is going to be the questions. And I'm sure Charlotte and our colleagues have thought about these things, and it'd be interesting to see what our view is on those things. But I think it was a beautiful study in every sense.
So Charlotte, he's really set you up nicely. What study do we need to perform next in this area? What are you and your group thinking about?
Yeah, I think there are two implications of this study. First, clinical, as Naveed says, we already had a sense that aortic diseases were heritable. And I think these data definitely support that we should probably screen first degree relatives. And I think at some extent, this is what the guidelines already encourage us to do. So I'm not sure it would be feasible to kind of randomize people or do a clinical trial where we screen some but not others. I'm not sure that would be ethical. I think the evidence is too strong for familial clustering and that we should probably screen these people. But I think also our estimates, they are so strong that I suspect that there are likely more genetic variants associated with, you know, non-syndromic orthopathies that we are not aware of as yet. So I think the next step would be to kind of try to disentangle the genetics a little bit more. I have seen some preliminary analysis based on the UK Biobank, for instance, and I think there are more genetic variants to come up with, also like more common genetic variants, at least, that we are not aware of as yet. So that would be the next step as I see it.
That might be particularly in younger probands, you know, those are the younger probands, right, isn't it? But it looks like, as you said, the hazard ratios, the risks are so high, it could also potentially be monogenic. But
yes,
anyway.
I agree.
Well, Charlotte, Naveed, we really appreciate your time and taking this opportunity to discuss these really interesting findings and helping us understand that truly there may be a familial component to understanding this disease process, particularly in patients with aortic aneurysms that may go on to develop aortic dissections. Well, listeners, we hope you have a great week. And on behalf of Carolyn and myself, catch you on the run next week. This program is copyright the American Heart Association 2020.